Hello, today I have a bonus podcast episode for you. I receive a lot of questions from listeners through various media, email, Facebook, Twitter, the discussion forum, and it's usually hard to get time to type out answers to all of these, especially when the issue raised is rather complex. I have decided to answer as many of these as I can through some special Q&A podcast episodes. For these episodes, I have recruited the help of some of my students to sit down and discuss these issues with me. This first session was recorded before the end of the semester. Joining me on this day were an enthusiastic bunch of Tolkien students: Carolyn Knuth, Kelly Tapata, Mac Boyle, Rachel Field, Will Malkus, and Eve Nealon. I should also warn you that this recording came out quite loud in most places, so especially if you're listening on an iPod, you want to turn your volume down in the next 5 seconds. Anyway, Rachel starts us off with our first question.
So our first question is, are goblins and orcs the same?
Right. Now, the first place that where this is introduced, of course, one major trend is that the word goblin is mostly used in The Hobbit, and the word orc is mostly used in The Lord of the Rings. So in part, it seems at least in part to be a pure language thing. That is, he's using simpler, more common, more juvenile language in The Hobbit, and so he uses the word goblin, which is the more traditional and kind of fairy tale version, though the word orc is used once in The Hobbit. And there, when he introduces it in The Hobbit, it seems to be not a racial distinction or like a different breed or anything like that, but actually just a size difference. That is, when he's talking about, he says that even the very large goblins, a positive, the great orcs of the mountains, end of positive, can run at high speeds even while bent over very low is the context. So it suggests that, the really big ones are called orcs. And there's another passage, actually just in rereading chapter 3 of book 3, the Merry and Pippin being dragged across Rohan chapter in the Lord of the Rings, which I was just reading for class. It uses the word goblins a couple times, but Merry and Pippin will often call them goblins because, they're hobbits, and hobbits seem to use the word goblin most, though orc is being used of this. When Aragorn and Gimli and Legolas and Éomer are talking about them, they call them orcs all the time. So that it seems to be kind of interchangeable. It's clear that there are different species of orcs. I mean, they talk about the black Uruks of Mordor, and clearly you have the Uruk-hai, which, is sort of the little orc eugenics experiment that Saruman has going on. So there definitely are different breeds, and it does seem to be the smaller orcs of the Misty Mountains, which are referred to not by Merry and Pippin, but by the narrator at one point there in Chapter 3 as goblins. So it seems to be, like a diminutive thing. But I'm not sure that you can say, like, orcs look like this and goblins look like that, and they're totally different things.
Well, what's interesting is I was just wondering, maybe it's kind of like goblins are to orcs as hobbits are to elves, and then, like, orcs are to Uruk-hai as elves are to humans.
So are you suggesting that goblins are made out of hobbits?
No, I'm saying this is an interesting comparison. If goblins are the small ones, then they're like hobbits, and then orcs are made from elves, so they're like elves, and then Uruk-hai are part man.
But I'm so like, lost.
Yeah, I totally lost the last part of the analogy too. It is true. Now, goblins, all of them, like as a species,
right,
they are presumably in the dominant story, derived from elves, and so the different subspecies or races of orcs that exist would clearly be differences akin to the differences between the different races of men.
Yeah,
in that way.
I was gonna say, I think it's more like the difference between the men of Gondor and the men of Bree. Like, they're just a little bit different.
But right.
Potato, potato.
Yeah, well, you've got the high... I mean, if Faramir introduces the terms, we're talking about men, talking about the high men and the lower men, and he uses the word middlemen, that the Gondorians are no longer high and they've become middlemen of the Twilight. So so you get different grades.
Could goblin be like a regional thing then? Because mostly we see the goblins in the Misty Mountains.
Are the goblins in the Misty Mountains under the direction of Sauron?
Ooh. Well,
because it could be that it's more of a nationality,
right? Like that is geographically rather than sort of ethnically based.
Yeah, the orcs that live in Mordor and get bossed around by by Saruman are orcs, and the ones that are like a separate political entity are the goblins.
Right. Possibly. I mean, again, it seems to me to have its origin linguistically. Like, again, in the completely different kind of linguistic register that The Hobbit as a book operates on. And the word goblin is still used, but it's in the vast minority, even of the Misty Mountain creatures in question, in The Lord of the Rings. So that's why, I mean, my primary response to it is always just to say, I think it's just essentially a synonym, which is sort of used in different times and in different, like, under different circumstances, like the targeting of the Hobbit, and in by different people, as in, like, the Hobbits talking about them instead of elves or dwarves talking about them. But
so technically, they're all orcs. But sometimes you call them goblins, depending on who you are and where they're from, and if you feel like it.
Maybe it's a racial slur.
That seems to be, well, it seems to be at least, like, a personal slur. That is, like, if you're puny, you might be called a goblin instead of an orc. But yeah, I mean, Carolyn, that does seem to be the way primarily that it's done in The Lord of the Rings. I mean, that seems to be a fair description there. Though, again, in The Hobbit, it's the other way. It's the other way around. They're goblins by default, and only orcs. The word orc is only used once or twice. So that difference to me is the primary thing, which suggests to me that that's really what mainly lies behind it.
But I mean, if you told a child and they were captured by a troop of orcs, they probably wouldn't understand it. Mm. So it makes sense, really.
Right, yeah. Goblins needs less explanation. I mean, it makes sense to use it in a children's book for that reason, especially, I mean, remember one of the major fantasy writers of the previous generation was George MacDonald. The Princess and the Goblin. I mean, the goblins are heavily involved in the Curdy books. So that would have been something that would have been familiar to a large portion of the Hobbit reading audience in the 30s. So it makes perfect sense for him to have chosen that word initially. But of course, the word goblin is not really fully integrated into the linguistic system, you know, that he has built, whereas orc is derived more from, is more consistent. It's an Anglo-Saxon word, so it fits in better with sort of the linguistic economy of the world that he subcreates.
I remember when I was reading, when I read The Hobbit when I was little, and then when I read The Lord of the Rings, I thought the difference was where they dwelled, basically, because I guess the movies propagate this, because when they're in Moria, you know, Legolas looks up the door, he says, goblins. And I always thought it meant the goblins lived underground.
Yeah.
And orcs lived above ground, because the ones in the Misty Mountain are goblins, and they live underground. And there's not a lot of mention of, like, the orcs of Mordor. They live in, like, towers and on the plains.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, and it's...
They make them look different in the movies.
Yes. Yeah. In the movies, they are very self-conscious about developing very different sort of strains and races of orcs. Mm-hmm. And they use the word orc and goblin very differentially, you know, to apply to the different races. It doesn't seem to me that line is drawn that clearly. That is the line between orc and goblin, specifically. Though there do seem to be, I mean, in chapter 3, we probably spend longest with orcs in that passage where Merry and Pippin are being dragged across Rohan. And there we do see three clearly different, and not just with different loyalties, but physiologically different orcs. The Misty Mountain orcs are smallest. Grishnak and the orcs of Mordor are a little bit larger, but they tend to be, like, you know, like, shorter and longer armed, and the Uruk-hai of Isengard are much, you know, by far the largest of the three. So even there, we do see clear differences. And I can certainly understand why, for the sake of simplicity, the filmmakers sort of took those words and used them as very sort of discrete labels.
The movies aren't canon, so we can't really...
Right, well, exactly. But this is, I think, one of the main reasons why this question tends to be confusing to people who then come to the books, because it is pretty clear in the movies. In the movies, you can tell the difference. There's a goblin over there, and there's an orc over there, and it's not... therefore, it gets kind of confusing when the words seem to be, as they are often, used apparently interchangeably.
The words seem to give us more information linguistically than scientifically.
Yeah.
You know, it's just...
Or like ethnographically. Or
yeah, it seems
like
to
that,
be
yeah.
more like yeah. a level of sinisterness.
Yeah. Yeah.
Than anything
possibly.
Else.
Yeah.
I always remember the goblins from the 1970s animated version of the Hobbit with the gigantic heads.
Yeah. Yeah.
Their creepy songs.
Yeah.
Though the Where There's a Whip, There's a Way song kicks butt. Yeah. It's not in The Hobbit. That's in The Return of the King, the animated Return of the King. Okay, we should move on to the second question, however.
Are there any details about the lands to the east of Mordor?
No.
But there should be. I want to know what those blue wizards are up to. That's where they went, right?
Yep, that's where they are.
Okay. The blue wizards. In the similarly, they're the wizards.
Yeah, there are five wizards total, and the two of them are the blue wizards.
It must be very boring. Nothing happened.
They're hanging out with the
elves. Maybe the blue wizards are just so much more complicated.
The one thing that we know about the lands east of Mordor in the Third Age is that they're populated by humans. So there are lots of men out there, huge nations of men, who have mostly, partially, we don't know how many there are, so we don't know what percentage, but anyway, that's where most of Sauron's armies come from. Many of them come up from the south, the Haradrim come up from the south, but they're also the Easterlings are mentioned. And in the history of Gondor, if you read in Appendix A, the sort of back history of the earlier Third Age history of Gondor from the establishment of the kingdom onwards, they're always fighting against Easter. I mean, there's like nations of people who will wander in from the east and cause huge trouble, like the Wing Riders, they were called, which means they ride chariots.
Are they the ones with the Oliphants?
The Oliphants come from the south, I think. I think they come from Herod, but maybe from the east as well. I mean, the east, it's south presumably east. Huge. I mean, there's no clear sense of how large the continent goes on. But anyway, so it's the source of the majority of Sauron's armies. And there are very few places where he talks about what the blue wizards were or were not up to out there in the east. But one of the places where he does talk about it, basically, he said, like, their job was to go out and to work in those eastern lands, basically to try to help cut off Sauron's support. Basically, to get them through. Well, see, exactly. Probably.
Or maybe they actually were relatively successful and Sauron only has a small percentage of them.
That's another. Because he basically proposes or implies both things at different points. Never does he write the story of the two blue wizards. There is one place where he says they were probably failures and became like the heads of cults of witchcraft and stuff like that. Or there's another place where he gives them names which imply that they actually were really effective or comparatively effective out in the east, and that things would have been far, far worse had the blue wizards not been doing whatever they were doing out there. But he never really specifies this. And I'm actually, probably the wizards are the number one thing that I keep getting asked about by email and stuff, so I actually plan to do like nothing but wizards session in which I just talk about that. So I'll come back to the blue wizards in a later session, and I'll read some of the passages that I'm alluding to where he mentions them, though again never tells the full story. But anyway, that's the main thing that we know about the East, is that it's full of kingdoms of men, and they are by and large allied with Sauron, and that's where most of his armies come from. We know that there's another army of Easterlings, for instance, which comes in at the time of the Battle of Pelennor Field, which comes in and attacks the Lonely Mountain in Dale. So I mean, those are Easterlings as well. Of course, the other thing we know about the ancient history of the East, of course, that's presumably out there somewhere, is where Cui Vienin is or was, where the elves awoke, and you know, they moved west.
Is the same thing that happened to the elves, did that happen to the men as well? Like, did the men start in the east like the elves and then move over?
Yeah.
So some of them chose to just stay over there?
Yeah. And so presumably there are elves in the east somewhere, like that is some of the Avari, the Unwilling, who never set out on the journey towards Valinor. Presumably, you know, if you went east, you would find some elves. I mean, they're, because they never spent any time with the Valar, they're pretty low grade elves, you know. But there are elves out there.
So would they actually be all that different from men?
Well,
they have pointy ears.
Pointier ears, anyway. But yes, when the orcs first appeared. The reaction over in Beleriand in the First Age, in the Silmarillion, was like, gosh, maybe these are Avari who have become corrupt. And there's concerning which they guessed all too near the truth, as the narrator ominously points out. But there's also a reference when men awake in Hildorian in the First Age that some of them are befriended by Dark Elves, by Avari. So they're clearly there, and they're clearly different. I don't know how many of them are there. We don't know anything about them. I mean, they pass out of history entirely. But presumably there are some still out there, but we're never really told any stories from the East or given any kinds of details.
It's a barren land with no narrators to be found.
Certainly none whose books make their way. And, you know, but that's actually exactly the point. You know, one of the things that is so fascinating about Tolkien's subcreation is the way in which he includes the textual history of the records within the history of his subcreation. So, you know, you might look at the maps and say, well, gosh, we just have this vague white line, you know, not too far east of the Anduin, we just fade out into nothingness. But that's, of course, because these are the stories that are of these lands and have been told by the people who live in these lands. There's no implication that those other lands don't have stories. It's just not these stories, and these people haven't visited there and don't know the stories, and so therefore we don't have the texts of those lands, which probably exist, but you know they didn't make it as far as Hobbiton, and so they or even Minas Tirith, and so they aren't in our collection.
Opening probably a whole other can of worms. Two things. One, the Silmarillion and Lord of the Rings are kind of supposed to be a form of, like, mythos for Britain, you said? Like, would the Easterlings and the lands to the east then be representative of the actual lands to the east of Britain? Because
probably
in the
not.
Movie,
yeah.
They make the Easterlings kind of look Arabic.
Right.
Just gonna say.
Well, the
I thought that was about, respect, yeah
the
southern,
with
the,
southern
with types.
With their wicker armor and that kind of thing. Well, I think that decision, the decision in the film, was based primarily upon the fact that it was clearly, I mean, it's, the Haradrim are a southern and
yeah.
therefore like vaguely
obviously.
Equatorial
yeah.
culture,
yeah.
Right. So they
I think Tolkien actually refers to them as darker at one point.
Yeah, they do have darker skins.
Well,
in the south.
The way the world is shaped, you'd have to have darker skin to live near the...
Yeah.
Well, I mean, unless
the
this
world
is set in...
The shaped.
I was going to say, unless this is set in the southern hemisphere, in which case, going to the north...
No,
I'm going to the south, but
yeah.
be away from the equator. So really, that's not a valid inference at all.
No, it is, because in the Silmarillion, we're clearly dealing with the far north. At the Helcaraxa and Utumno and Angband and stuff. So there's clearly that those are the northern parts of the world, and the farther north you go, the colder it gets. So we're clearly northern hemispherical in Middle Earth. So I do think that therefore that actually is valid. One like quick thing about the mythology of England thing. Two things. One, the fact that he was thinking about England doesn't necessarily mean that we can then sort of compare other things. I mean, it's not like the Shire in particular is England. I mean, in fact, what was England? What was England in the original versions was actually Elvenholm. Was the Lonely Isle was England. So it's not the Shire or Middle Earth itself.
I don't know what is.
So, let's move. Oh, wait, no. One last thing about the mythos. He did, by the time The Lord of the Rings, well before The Lord of the Rings came out, he had kind of abandoned the England-specific element of it. It had kind of broadened beyond that. So it really, in the finished product, it's not really, we shouldn't be thinking in those kinds of terms, like equating things with England. I mean, certainly the Shire culture bears certain superficial resemblances to traditional pre-industrial British culture,
but
yeah, that's not really,
I mean,
it's not really the way he was
some
thinking.
Some other things I can, like, I'll be just finding similarities and start to wonder how much am I looking into this too much?
Right. In some places, possibly a little bit. I mean, in some places, I think that there are definitely some resemblances. But
was the Watcher really searching for the ring?
Right, the Watcher in the Water. So this question stems from a very brief reference in the Fellowship of the Ring, when after the Watcher in the Water, which is the huge lake squid creature who attacks them before they enter Moria.
The Kraken.
Something like that. Yeah, it's Sulu. Some kind of squid-ish creature. Anyway, after they escape it, Gandalf has just said there are older and fouler things than orcs in the deep places of the world, and the narrator adds, he did not speak aloud his thought that whatever it was that dwelt in the lake, it had seized on Frodo first among all the company. So Gandalf appears to suspect, at least, that it is not a coincidence that of all the people, Frodo happened to be the one who was grabbed first. And so that, I would say, is where this question comes from. And it's a complicated question. I suspect that Gandalf's hint that it's not an accident is probably right, but I don't think...
Gandalf tends to know what he's talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think that probably wouldn't have been said if there were absolutely not... I mean, I think... I couldn't imagine the answer being, Gandalf was just screwed up. I'm sure it's nothing.
If he was looking for a plump and tasty morsel, he would have grabbed Sam.
Well, one of the things, I was thinking about this logistically.
Now, there's no actual textual evidence that Sam is much heavier than anybody else.
Or maybe Fatty Lumpkin.
There is textual evidence that Fatty Lumpkin is fatter than other people. And Fatty Bulger. But not Sam. Just thought I'd mention
that.
Well, if you think about it logistically, they, as far as they know, the danger they're going to be facing going into Moria is going to come at them from in Moria.
Yeah.
And they're entering Moria. And the hobbits are the smallest and weakest of their group. So it would make sense to put them at the back.
Yeah.
And if the thing's attacking them from behind, then...
And it does seem, I mean, as they're going in the doors, others have already started to go in. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
so they clearly are, I mean...
To 1 to 4.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem that there's, okay, possibly... That would sort of support a coincidence thing. But I don't think it's entirely coincidence. However, the main thing that I would say, I don't think it would be right to say that he, the Watcher in the Water, was attempting to get the ring. Like, that this was some sort of plot on his part to... Obviously, he had no idea that the ring was coming. So there's no possibility of premeditation on the part of the Watcher in the Water. But also, I'm not even sure that it would, you know, recognize, oh my gosh, that is the Ring of Power. I desire the Ring of Power for myself and shall become... I mean, I...
Dude, that would have been an excellent monologue.
Instead of the Dark Lord, we should have a squid!
I should become Cthulhu and I will rule everything.
Yeah, so I just can't see. But I don't think that means it's just an accident and has no idea.
It seems that evil begets evil. You know, bad things
I was gonna say.
Are constantly happening to ring bearers.
Well, yeah, certainly that, in terms of just like a piece of misfortune happening to him. And even, you know, we certainly have the ring wanting to expose itself and to escape. From Gollum, you know, we're told the ring tried to escape. Does the ring want to try to escape from Frodo at this point? I mean, would it seem
like that would be a poor judgment call.
What, eaten by a squid?
Yeah.
Just dropped on the shore. No one goes to Moria anymore. It's
not 100% sure that you know that the ring. I've said this in class. I'm not convinced that the ring is capable of very good long term thinking and or extended planning. And so maybe perhaps it would be. I do think the ring makes bad judgment calls. I think that it makes demonstrably bad judgment calls at times.
I mean, it's still better than being taken to Mount Doom, but I mean...
But it would have no idea that it's being taken to Mount Doom, I think.
You can't hear what people are thinking when they're wearing it?
I'm not sure that it is really that sentient, that it's really kind of tracking what's going on and able to think about it. I don't know that there's enough evidence that the ring really sort of has a separate consciousness.
It's more like it just wants to pass hands as quickly as possible, and through that means it'll get to wherever it needs to be.
Yeah, I mean, it abandons Gollum, right? I mean, it leaves Gollum because it knows that it's a dead end. It's like, man, I've been down here forever. But see, that's just no more is required than, like, the perception of its immediate surroundings to say, hey, I'm not getting any closer to Sauron here. I really want to. This is lame. So let's leave. And I'm not sure that Bilbo picks up the ring, which of course Gandalf says is not the ring's plan, obviously. But when Bilbo picks up the ring, I mean, I don't see any reason to think that the ring is going to be like, oh crap. I don't think it had that much plan. So anyway, at least it's hard to say. the way the ring is treated in the books, it doesn't seem like we can build a consistent sense of, like, it's got a master plan.
But if that's all the ring cares about, then there's no... If, like, it's not that sentient and all it really wants is to move towards Mordor, then there's absolutely no reason for it to leave Frodo. Because it doesn't know that Frodo's going to destroy it. It just knows that it's going in the direction it wants to go.
Quite possibly. I mean, it, the times that we see it appearing to want to leave is when it wants to reveal itself to the ring
wraiths.
And therefore get on the express route. So
its best move at this point would probably be to turn Frodo into the littlest ring wraith.
Right, which it's working on.
And Moria in general, it says explicitly in the Council of Elrond, Glowin says that, like, the power of Mordor has gone back to Moria, and that's why Glowin and Orion haven't come.
Glowin is not that. He's at the council. Balin is.
Oh, Balin. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. What? One of the dwarves, like three of them, went back
to
Moria.
They all look the same to me.
They're short guys. They never came
Except
back.
Except Bomber's really fat. That's
Sometimes beards.
Yeah.
But so couldn't that just mean that the Watcher maybe has become more evil? I don't know if a creature like that can be more evil than they were before, or like if the fact that they weren't, that Sauron's pretty much commanded the critters of Moria to,
I don't think we need to see them being actively deployed by Sauron. They're older and fouler things than orcs. And this is right after Gandalf has made the speech about, you know, there are other things in the world. You know, when people are talking, when they're debating about whether or not Sauron is causing the snow in Carathras, and Gandalf is like, guys, there are other things besides Sauron that are evil in the world and that are not friends to elves and men and dwarves. So, they can be total free agents. In fact, I was just flipping through Tolkien's letters earlier and came to a passage where he was really objecting to the fact that in one of the BBC radio versions of The Lord of the Rings in the 50s, he hated the fact that they introduced Old Man Willow as a servant of Sauron.
Oh,
yeah, he really hated that. They also introduced Cold Perius as Tom Bombadil's daughter. But
she's my daughter.
Yeah, he objected to that even more. But anyway, the point that he went on to make about that, he said people seem not to be able to conceive of, you know, like an evil creature which is just a free agent and you know opposes them but is not actually acting under the orders of Sauron. And there are so I think the Watcher is clearly in that category.
See, I always thought when he made that speech that he was alluding to the Balrog. I don't know why,
well,
but
the
that's
Balrog
always
too,
what
now,
I thought.
The, the difference is with the Balrog, we have like a kind of like political background there. I mean, we know where their loyalties lie. Yeah, yeah. So I mean, we know where they used to be in. They were related to Sauron, but he's not operating under Sauron's orders.
Because Sauron did give him his wings.
Oh, please.
Going off of that, because the Balrogs, you know, were kind of inherited from Morgoth to Sauron.
Yeah.
After Morgoth bails, could the and all the dark things of the old world and the Silmarillion serve Morgoth? So could this the Watcher be one of those servants?
Well, I guess
from
I would say
the first age?
Two things. First of all of the evil things have their origin in Morgoth.
Right.
But many of them go on to become free agents. Remember, one of the fundamental realities of, like, the evil creature world is self-interest. They want to set up on their own. They don't want to serve Morgoth. So we see, for instance, Ungoliant at the very beginning going off, and she sets up on her own, and she doesn't. And this is why we have Shelob later on, who was also clearly in this sense a free agent. Sauron uses her, but she doesn't obey him. She's not serving him. She's not in any explicit relationship with him. And so, presumably, many of the monstrous creatures that Morgoth produced, you know, during his very fertile research and development years in the First Age, are still wandering around and doing their own thing, unconnected to anybody else.
So, in that case, could the Watcher be sort of a rival to Sauron? In a sense that all dark things are rivals to one another, and when the ring walked by, he was like, wait a second.
I doubt the Watcher in the Water was that it was part of a long term, a larger strategy, okay. either of like squid superiority or like I'm going to stick in Sauron's eye, but rather. It seems to me the likeliest explanation is just he detects the power there. Like, mm-hmm. there is something...
There's something cool and evil, yes. and ooh, the, cool, that evil, looks, like, shiny!
Yeah,
just
exactly.
like Boromir, I could use that. Yoink.
Yeah, or even if he doesn't have any idea what it is, but, like, mm-hmm. there's something different yeah. about this God, one. I it can sense that, and so goes for him. Probably not even knowing why. I mean, I don't know how much of a conscious... mind we're supposed to be attributing to the Watcher in the Water. It is called a Watcher, which is interesting.
He's smart.
Yeah. Thulu is a squid. He's brilliant.
He's not a squid.
He looks like a squid. The Watcher's not a squid either. He just looks like a squid.
Anyways.
I would like to suggest...
puppies later. Let's stop having Cthulhu tangents.
Puppies!
I would like to suggest an alternate motivation for the Watcher.
Okay.
Magic
yes.
is delicious.
Right. You know, this has,
he this wants has, to eat it.
This has precedent. Ungoliant. I mean, this is what Ungoliant does. True. You know, that which has power can be not only just utilized or exploited, but actually absorbed. And therefore, the absorber, under certain circumstances, yeah. becomes more powerful. That is conceivable. I mean, I think that and it may well be when it detects somehow that there's something different or special about Frodo that there's...
I mean, he's carrying three different powerful items, ring, sword, mithril armor.
Mithril's not magic.
But it's cool.
It is shiny.
Cool. Yeah, shiny, though, the shininess
cool and
is hidden.
Shiny,
but I mean, I think... That seems to me possible, that it detects the power and doesn't want to use it, but wants to absorb it.
Does Gandalf torture Gollum? If so, is that supposed to be okay?
Okay, and the passage we're dealing with here is when Gandalf, in The Shadow of the Past, Chapter 2 of Fellowship of the Ring, is, page 55, is talking to Frodo and telling him the story of Gollum and how he finally found Gollum and made him talk. Gandalf says, I endured him as long as I could, but the truth was desperately important, and in the end, I had to be harsh. I put the fear of fire on him, and wrung the true story out of him bit by bit, together with much sniveling and snarling. He thought he was misunderstood and ill-used. Mm. That's the passage in question. One could certainly exonerate Gandalf on a technicality that, you know, he doesn't say he actually applied fire to Gollum, and so there's no evidence of physical torture. He put the fear of fire in him, so he plainly threatened him.
I assume he just magicked him.
Well, threatened to magic him anyway.
Threatened him with the ring, you know, the one of fire that he's on his hand.
Though he wouldn't threaten him with it explicitly, because it's a secret.
The best kept secret of Middle-earth.
He tells the Balrog, so apparently he's not that big on keeping it a secret from evil beings.
Well, that's...
He just, like, slips it out. By the way, I'm carrying the ring.
Slip out. Of course,
it's in a positive phrase within his threat.
Yeah. But it's not that it slips out. Of course, at the Bridge of Khazad Dûm, he is declaring himself. And that's what you do. I mean, if you want to declare your power, I mean, when he's standing up with the Balrog...
He's
bring
out the big guns.
Yeah.
I mean, Gandalf is as much a Maiar as he is.
Well,
aren't Balrogs Maiar?
Yeah. No, their spirits of fire corrupted by Morgoth, so they are Maiar.
What about that little trick that he does that he just does to Bilbo, where he's like, Bilbo, leave the ring, and Bilbo's like, no, and he seems to grow taller and. More powerful.
Yeah. And there, the implication there is basically, you know, he says, then you will see Gandalf the Grey uncloaked.
Mm-hmm.
And the cloak that he seems to be implying here is just, he doesn't normally reveal his, I mean, he is much more powerful than, I mean, he goes around in the guise of an old man, you know, and he I mean, it's not that he doesn't actually have a body or anything, but he doesn't show his power all the time, and here he's basically revealing some of his true stature is the word that Tolkien uses so often about things like this. I mean, he has really great stature, not just height, but sort of metaphysical stature.
Ankle.
Sort of showing, I don't know if the ankle business, but anyway, he's sort of showing a little bit of who he really is, which he's doing in full with the Balrog, in the Balrog scene. But the point is, I clearly don't think he would have to do this with...
actual fire.
Right, or he wouldn't have to do that with Gollum. Presumably, some comparatively normal fire would do the trick if he's threatening.
If you think about it, it makes perfect sense for Gollum to be really scared of fire. Like, he's been living under this mountain in a dark cave. The natural light source would come from, like, the moss, I guess. But no, he hasn't seen fire since probably he was one of the river folk.
Right.
And he, you know, the whole sun thing, doesn't like the sun. The sun's just this big ball of fire.
Right, exactly. And he, remember, it's the flame of honor, or the flame of the sun that Gandalf had. But yeah, remember also when, in the Two Towers, when Sam lights a fire, Gollum freaks out.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly one of the things that he's freaked out about is that it's going to make a smoke and bring enemies. But that's the last point that he makes. He talks about fire as if fire is itself an enemy. I mean, you know, it bites it destroys you. He clearly is afraid of fire in general.
Yeah.
And remember the other people who are afraid of fire.
The
Ringwraiths. Exactly, the Ringwraiths. Yeah, the Ringwraiths are afraid of fire.
I wonder how they managed to work with the Balrogs.
They don't. They don't at all.
Balrogs are the first age thing.
Yeah, they're constitutionally different. This is implied. When they're on the River Anduin and the winged Nazgul is sort of lifting up and Legolas shoots him. Is that what you've been talking about?
Well, wouldn't it make sense for Gollum to be afraid of fire and the Ringwraiths to be afraid of fire, because wasn't the ring turning Gollum into a Ringwraith?
Yeah.
So that would
Exactly. It would make sense. When they all sense, when the winged Nazgul takes off and Legolas shoots its mount down, they don't know what it is, but they all sense that there's some seriously evil, powerful thing rising up into the air on the other side of the river, and they're speculating. They're like, "What was it? Was it, you know?" And I forget who asks or speculates that it might have been a Balrog, and Frodo says, "No, it wasn't a Balrog, but something colder." And so, I mean, there's like this heat cold thing. That's what I meant when I said constitutionally different.
I mean, of course it was a Balrog. It had wings, didn't it?
But anyway. So, Ringwraiths are afraid of fire. Balrog's obviously not going to be afraid of fire, but Ringwraiths are, Gollum seems to be. And it seems to be, when Strider is explaining that, about the Ringwraiths being afraid of fire, he says Sauron can put fire to his evil uses, but these riders do not love it. I mean, there seems to be, and through Gandalf and his connections with fire, there seems to be some kind of power which is usable for good, and which many of the servants of evil fear in fire. Goblins don't. Of course, remember back in The Hobbit, the wargs are afraid of fire, like normal wolves would be, and the goblins are not. So,
but this kind of goes back, like, all the way to the Silmarillion. Isn't there the thing where, oh god, and now I'm going to start confusing names. The one who made the Silmarils, and he was named
Fëanor, the Spirit of Fire.
And then, like, was like, and too much so far corrupted him, and then, like, the sun was made of fire, and someone wanted her, but could not get Morgoth, I think, was like, goodness, that looks tasty.
But he's afraid of her.
Yeah, but he's afraid of her.
And the fear of the sun, I mean, is connected to the fear of fire. I mean, goblins are afraid of the sun, and they're not afraid of they work with fire and are not afraid of flames, but there are connections to
climb on, move really under the sun.
Is there another reason why the Ringwraiths are scared of it? Because the sun and the warmth are associated with humans. Because when you cross orcs with men, you get Uruk-hai who can move around in the daylight perfectly fine. So it's clearly a man thing.
Yes,
and like elves are associated with the moon and the stars, and you know, so is that why they're afraid of fire? Because it reminds them of what they used to be.
I don't know. It's a good question. I mean, he never explains why Ringwraiths do not love fire, as Aragorn says.
So was Gollum, like, really in the process of becoming a Ringwraith? Or did he? Or was there some sort of block that was going to keep him from getting there?
Well, he lost the ring.
I mean, besides losing the ring.
No, he didn't keep him with him all the time. He only used it when he was hunting.
Yeah, that was another thing that Gandalf says. That one of the things that inhibited his becoming a Wraith was the fact that he didn't wear it very much. But, yes, he was wraithifying. I mean, there's no question that he...
So it's clearly possible to keep the ring for hundreds of years and not actually be wraithified.
If you're a hobbit, and if you don't wear it that often, yes.
Also, in that case, why did the ring want to get away from Gollum? Because one would assume that he would eventually become a ring wraith, and then he would be in contact with Sauron, and then, you know...
Would he be, like, a free agent ring wraith, though? Because...
Wraiths turn into Barrow-wights if they're not, like, captured?
No, the Barrow-wights are different. The Barrow-wights are different. The Barrow-wights are spirits that entered into the Barrows.
But, like, so, yeah. I mean, like, Barrow-like, in that they're just spirits that kind of wander around screwing with people. Or do you have... Or in being a wraith, are you explicitly tied to Sauron, period?
When Gandalf talks about... the prospect of Frodo having been made a wraith, but even there, that's from the Morgul knife, not from the ring itself.
Yeah.
And if he had been made into a wraith from the wound of the Morgul knife, he would have been, Gandalf said he would have been a shadow under his great shadows. Yeah. I mean, he would have been a subordinate, an explicitly subordinate wraith.
Though it seems that, I guess it would make sense, because the ring wraiths themselves turned into wraiths when they were given the rings by Sauron that let him control them, so carrying even the one ring would probably make you a Sauron ring wraith.
Because it is from the one ring, I would kind of have to imagine that... the reason that the One Ring is what it is that it has much of Sauron's own power and spirit in it. So I can't imagine that you could become a ring wraith from wearing the One Ring and not be connected to or subordinate to Sauron.
The ring probably just got fed up with being held by a hobbit for hundreds of years.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's clearly it wasn't making any progress. And I think this, I mean, if you want, could be used as an example. As evidence for the ring's lack of long-term thinking. I mean, it could have just said, hey, you know, sooner or later, Gollum's going to become a wraith, and so let me just work on that, and then once it becomes a... But it clearly doesn't seem to be thinking that strategically. But anyway, back to... We've kind of strayed away from the torture question. The one way in which I think the fire discussion is relevant is that it's clear that Gollum is afraid of fire, unusually afraid of fire, and so it's not like... When he says, I put the fear of fire in him, that, you know, he was, like, holding an open flame underneath, you know, like, you know, Gollum's hand or something and being like, I'm going to, you know, burn you if you don't. Clearly, Gollum gets so freaked out when a campfire is set near him that it wouldn't take much to inspire fear in him with fire. So...
He might have just used a firework. Like, that was actually
something
that
I always said, I'm going to make a fire.
So when he says harsh, it's not like he's downplaying what he did. He's being honest. He was like, eventually I had to be stern with him.
Yeah.
I had to tell him, you know, I might...
I'm going to hurt you if you don't tell me what I want to.
It could be construed as a sort of psychological torture, because he's playing on a severe phobia.
Right. Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, and Will, I agree with you that... Gandalf is not, it doesn't seem to be especially proud of this, you know, he's not, nor is he suggesting that it's not at all any kind of a big deal. You know, he does justify it, but the truth was desperately important.
Like, when it's phrased that way, it sounds like he just scolded him, really.
Yeah, that I had to be harsh, like, I had to speak really harshly. Aragorn uses... similar kind of language. He says that he wasn't gentle to Gollum. I don't think that necessarily means that, you know, Aragorn beat the crap out of him. but he says he wasn't gentle. So, I mean, he probably was rough physically with him in trying to restrain him and trying to keep him from running away, dragging him. He had to tie him up. He said he made him walk in front of him.
Yeah.
And presumably, you know, Gollum tried to escape and he had to be rough in keeping him and not letting him escape. And then and until he was tamed by lack of food and water, Aragorn says. I mean, he starved him.
Yeah.
But again, the Petruchio deal.
Yeah.
Wait. Okay, that is a deeply creepy parallel.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'm going to stop thinking about that as fast as I can. Anyway, though it's not obvious that Aragorn was like, and my strategy shall be to withhold food. Gollum, I mean, when Frodo and Sam capture Gollum, we see Gollum being pretty stubborn initially when they tie the rope on him and everything. So I am not sure how much of the starvation was wholly Aragorn initiated. Like that, Gollum was begging for food and he was saying no. I don't necessarily think that. But Gollum was not cooperative until he reached the point where he was desperate for food and drink and was therefore willing to go along and to play along.
Gollum's
with
a bit of a tough cookie to crack.
Well, he is tough.
No crunchings and munchings.
No crunchings and munchings. Exactly. No crunchings and munchings for Gollum.
So then is Tolkien saying that it's okay to torture if you don't actually beat the person up, you just mentally screw with them?
It sounds like he's saying sometimes it's necessary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it's one of those ends justifies the
well,
ends.
There is.
Which is very unusual for this book, so we're not
it
sure.
Is.
So
and
I'm not sure if we can say that's what he's saying.
And I think that that's exactly, I think that that's what prompted this question, because that would be nowhere else. I mean, Mac is right. Nowhere else in these books is an ends justifies the means ethic endorsed at all.
Except by, like, Saruman.
Right, exactly. It's only in Evil People that's justified. Right,
yeah.
Right. Boromir, it doesn't go as explicitly to ends and means, but yes, now he's clearly kind of thinking in those ways. But here I guess I would come back to, Will, what you said before, because I think that you're right about Gandalf's tone here. You know, he's saying, look, I had to, the truth is desperately important, I had to get him to talk. He doesn't seem to have tortured him. He seems to have threatened him. Yes, I don't know if you just say, like, if the ends are really important and the means are
really
not that big of a deal.
that Gollum had was crucial, and indeed
yeah.
it was. I mean, he found out, like, the most important things he needed to know before Frodo even set out on
yeah.
the journey.
Yeah, so the question is, I mean, but of course, we don't really know what the
what would have resulted if he had it.
Right, exactly. What would the later stages have been? Would Gandalf have actually gone on, you know, to actually use physical torture had he refused or not? I mean, I tend to think not, because it would be so out of keeping not only with Gandalf's character but with the ethics advocated throughout these books that it's hard to imagine.
Could he technically have just read his mind? Like, couldn't he have put him under some sort of a spell and just, like, read his mind? Because he says he does that to Frodo when he's,
yeah.
like, going
yeah, that
on
he did read his thought.
Gollum is arguably much further along the path towards Wraithhood than Frodo is, but...
And therefore one wonders if perhaps it might have been harder.
Well, maybe.
But I don't know. I don't know. I mean, we can say apparently he couldn't do that because he didn't, but...
So maybe Smeagol is just a manifestation of Stockholm Syndrome later along.
Oh, God.
Why?
Well, I mean, that's actually an argument that people make, of course. I mean, especially with the way that he treats Frodo
mm-hmm.
Later on, or at least most of the time, you know, like when he's not betraying him. But
Stockholm Syndrome, huh? Just like Petruchio.
Well, I knew you were going to go there again.
I said I wanted to not think about that.
You want
to
go on the next question?
Yeah, I was going to go on the next question.
What do Frodo and Bilbo and all the other ring bearers do across the sea?
Die
is the answer.
Eventually.
Yeah. And this is a really important thing.
Yes, more quickly.
More quickly, right, exactly. They will certainly die, because they will not, they just living over there doesn't make you immortal, and they will die more quickly, because when mortals go over to a mountain, they can't handle it. They'll be overloaded and all done. Exactly. Again, good way to go. My favorite COD, if I had to choose, I'd like excess of bliss and happiness would be my favorite way to go. But, they would die and sooner, though the reason for going, of course, is to achieve healing. And Tolkien does say that they would be healed, over there, and so therefore be happy and whole and then die.
But it's not like saying that you go across the sea means, like, passing on.
Exactly. That's exactly the point that I wanted to make.
It doesn't mean that.
Legitimately,
this is one
you're
of
going
the things,
to another place.
Right, and then you will die. Right, exactly. And this is...
On this separate continent that is actually a real continent.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. They're not in our spherical world anymore, but that's a little complicated. But anyway, yes, it's still within Arda. But this, I think, is a really important point post-films, because the films... I did a fantastic job of messing with people's understanding of this. In fact, even most notably, in that passage, I'm talking about it like it's a book. In that scene in the film, in The Return of the King, when Gandalf and Pippin are talking during the Siege of Minas Tirith, and they're talking about death, Gandalf quotes in describing, you know, where dead people go to Pippin, presumably is what he's describing. When describing that, he uses out of context. Let's not blame Gandalf for this. Valinor. It's from the passage that describes them getting to Valinor.
That always bothered me because he's totally lying to Pippin, because that's not what's going to happen.
That's not what's going to happen when you die. The point is, we don't know what happens when you die. I mean, when mortals die, they go, the elves know not whither. The books never go beyond that. And
when the elves die, they get stacked up in Manwë's storehouse.
they go to that. Now, elves go to the place that Gandalf is adapting, the far green country under a swift sunrise. That's a quotation from the description of Valinor when they get there. And so it creates the impression that when you set sail from the havens, you're setting sail for, you know, the land of the dead or for the afterlife in some sense. And that's absolutely not the case. And it really confuses the whole system of mortality versus immortality. And that was really important to Tolkien. I mean, he felt that mortality and immortality were, you know, was some of the major themes of the Lord of the Rings. And in fact, when in a letter once somebody asked him, like, what do you think is the most important theme in the Lord of the Rings? He said mortality. So that's, though he added to that saying, but that's not really saying very much, because to say that is really just to say that it's a book written by a human being, and that really all human art is about mortality on some level or other. That, I think, is a really important confusion to be cleared up. They will depart and go to wherever it is that people go when they die, from Valinor, but they are totally not the land of the dead. That's good. I think we've pretty much answered that.
Religion in Middle Earth. Why isn't there any?
Right. That's the question. So the answer to the question is kind of a complicated question. Yeah, Kelly, go ahead.
The thing that strikes me about C.S. Lewis and Tolkien, because they're contemporaries and they're buddies, is that they both usually approach religion from, you know, the point of view of an outsider. A lot of the books that C.S. Lewis writes, like the Screwtape Letters and the Chronicles of Narnia, they handle religious themes and things like that, but they do it, you know, from the point of view of a demon or a bunch of kids who are having this wonderful experience with a magical lion who bears no resemblance whatsoever to Jesus. It sort of makes these things more accessible to a broader range of people who aren't going in thinking, here I'm going to read about Christianity, and it's going to be so stodgy and hoity-toity.
Yeah. And now Lewis, of course, is dealing explicitly with Christianity more, and his books are more explicitly Christian. That's not a very meaningful thing to say, but I think you know what I mean. And because it makes allusions to Christianity, like actual allusions to Christianity, like the moment when Aslan says to the Pevensey kids, you have to learn to know me by another name in your world. So, I mean, and he's alluding to Jesus there explicitly, though not by name. So, Tolkien, of course, never does that kind of thing. So in that kind of sense, they're more Christian. But I agree, within the world of Narnia, there's no religion. If we define religion as the outward practice, of worship, there's no religion in Narnia either. Howsoever Christian the books and the world may be, howsoever devoted to Aslan and the Emperor over the sea the Narnians may be, they don't have churches, they don't go to worship services, they don't have that kind of thing. Yes.
I would like to say that there is religion in Middle-earth and Narnia that just happens to be manifested in the way that they live and behave and not in...
Right.
The way they burn incense.
There's religion
chant.
Even in the classical sense in Middle Earth. The elves worship Manwë and
revere them anyway, and call upon them. Elbereth, or Varda.
All about Elbereth.
They acknowledge their existence because you know they're actually over there, and they try to talk to them if they need help.
Yeah,
but they don't have churches.
They pray to Elbereth though because she can hear them.
They do offer prayers to them. But again, there aren't worships. There are, in Valinor, we see festivals. The festival of the giving of the first fruits of the harvest. what they're doing when Morgoth and Ungoliant come in, right? And of course, you have also famously in Numenor, the Menal Tarma and the observances that happen on top of the Menal Tarma. And there is a shrine to Eru there. So it's the only physical location that's listed in Middle-earth, or near Middle-earth, Numenor not technically in Middle-earth, where there is a place to worship God in. It's the only it's not exactly a church, it's a mountaintop. And it's paralleled to the Holy Mountain in Valinor. But yeah, go ahead.
I was just thinking of the way that C.S. Lewis constantly tries to define church. It's not a place that you go, or the clergy, it's the entire body of people who make up this faith throughout all time.
Yeah, yeah. No, so let me read a passage from Tolkien's letters where he addresses this, because I think it will help. He says, There are no temples or churches or fanes in this world among good peoples. They had little or no religion in the sense of worship. For help they may call on a Vala, as Elbereth, as a Catholic might call on a saint, though no doubt knowing in theory as well as he, that is as well as the Catholic, that the power of the Vala was limited and derivative. But this is a primitive age, and these folk may be said to view the Valar as children view their parents or immediate adult superiors, and though they know they are subjects of the king, he does not live in their country, nor have there any dwelling. I do not think hobbits practiced any form of worship or prayer, unless through exceptional contact with elves. The Numenorians, and others of that branch of humanity that fought against Morgoth, even if they elected to remain in Middle-earth and did not go to Numenor, such as the Rohirrim, were pure monotheists. But there was no temple in Numenor until Sauron introduced the cult of Morgoth. The top of the mountain, the Menal Tarma, or Pillar of Heaven, was dedicated to Eru, the One, and there at any time, privately, and at certain times, publicly, God was invoked, praised, and adored, an imitation of the Valar and the mountain of Aman. But Numenor fell and was destroyed, and the mountain engulfed, and there was no substitute. Among the exiles, that is, the exiles from Numenor, remnants of the faithful who had not adopted the false religion, nor taken part in the rebellion, religion as divine worship, though perhaps not as philosophy and metaphysics, seems to have played a small part, though a glimpse of it is caught in Faramir's remark on grace at meat in the Two Towers. They pray before the meal. One of the only other, like, obviously religious acts that we see people taking part in. Yeah, okay.
One question I had is, how do the dwarves feel about Aule? Do they recognize, do they know that he created them?
Yes.
Do they worship him?
Well, see, worship is tricky.
They preach.
Because
they
view
him.
But in the same way that the Numenorians worship Eru, and is it safe to say that they do worship Eru? Because he's the one, he's their creator.
Yes.
So Aule would be the same to the dwarves.
Maker. Not creator.
Well, all right, maker, but
yeah. Because remember, I mean, in the story with Aule and Yavanna, I mean, it's, you know, what was made the joke in class about the dwarves being the stepchildren of Iluvatar, right? But the point is, they're still, or perhaps the more charitable, though less comical, phrase would be adopted children
of Iluvatar.
And
Aule is solely responsible.
The image of adoption. Well, he's responsible for their making.
Yes.
But Iluvatar is solely responsible for making them into people. They were just
automatons.
Yeah, they were just machines, essentially.
Robots.
Robots. Prior to
Aule made them and Iluvatar created them.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So it is only by the word adoption Tolkien uses in that passage. You know, we've got the children of his design and the children of his adoption. Mm-hmm. So by making them adopted children, Iluvatar is basically creating them. So they would stand in a similar relationship to the rest of the children, and therefore to God, and it wouldn't be appropriate for the. If you think about it, it would be. Aule knows that he screwed up,
mm-hmm.
And he describes the dwarves as the work of his presumption, because in trying to make children, he was putting himself in Iluvatar's place. But he responds in humility when Iluvatar comes down and implicitly rebukes him for it. And so, therefore, for the dwarves to revere Aule as if he were Iluvatar would be basically to recreate the bad situation that Aule was repenting of.
Okay.
And certainly if he accepted their worship, he would be doing the same thing again that he had done, the same kind of presumption before.
So did they worship Iluvatar at all? And all, by the same
no evidence of it. But again, there's no evidence with hobbits either.
I was going to say, do hobbits have any religion that's ever mentioned?
Nope.
Okay.
Nope.
I mean, especially with elves and with a lot of the humans, it seems very, like, ritualistic as opposed to religious, and they actually, like, I would compare them to the Laotians, which no one's gonna know anything about Laos religion except me, but they worship ancestors. It's an ancestral thing, and like all of the songs just made for the great heroes.
I would be careful here though, because he is, Tolkien is clear. I mean, in that note that I just read, they're monotheistic. They're monotheistic. But it doesn't enter the practice of their lives. I think that the distinction he makes at the end there, and here he's talking about men, he's talking about hobbits explicitly, but I think that that's actually a really interesting one. Among the exiles, religion as divine worship, though perhaps not as philosophy and metaphysics, seems to have played a small part. That is, divine worship itself, like building a church, praying to worshiping God, seems to play a small part in their culture. But he suggests it does not, perhaps, play a small part in their philosophy and metaphysics. That is, it impacts their worldview significantly. They still live in a firmly monotheistic worldview. And so, therefore, to be connecting the spiritual outlook of hobbits or men or elves or any of them to non-monotheistic religions would seem to be inappropriate. That is, to things like ancestor worship or animism or pantheism. Yeah, they operate from a monotheistic standpoint. They just don't worship. They just don't have churches. And he says they're primitive peoples. This is all, and historically, this is all very pre-Christian. You know, I mean, that basically their society is like other pre-Christian cultures, which also, many of which were, you know, some of which were spiritual, monotheistic, yes.
I feel like something, people you might be able to compare them to more easily is the early Celtic Christians, because they've been, at this point, they've been converted to Christianity, so they're monotheistic, but the Celts also said, operated under the assumption that everything that you do is in some way a prayer. So they would have a prayer for washing your hands, a prayer for preparing food. Everything, how you live your life in every way is in itself a prayer to what created you.
Yeah, that explicit acts of outward worship, devotion, or piety don't factor in, but yet nevertheless it's still... The reference, which is still kind of a sort of a vague-ish one, that he makes in that note was, though they know they are subjects of the king, he does not live in their country, nor have there any dwelling. That, of course, is the difference pre- and post-Christian. Post-Christianity, you know, post-incarnation, the king does live in your country and have there a dwelling. Prior to that, he doesn't. And so there's some sort of differences in expectations. You know, Tolkien didn't want and wasn't writing a story that was supposed to take place in our world. You know, that was supposed to be. And I know that I've heard people use this set of observations, that is the there aren't any churches and nobody seems to worship anybody observations, as basically attempted counter-arguments against Tolkien's world is basically a Christian world and that his Christianity is a huge factor in his sub-creation. But I think it's, in the end, a really shallow counter-argument against that. The philosophy and metaphysics of Tolkien's world are Christian. The worship practices are not. But that's just because he did not want his subcreated world, that in his subcreated world, people just running around doing imitations of Christian stuff. To give a parallel, in the Middle Ages, there was no concept of anachronism, so when they told stories of the ancient past, they made people look just like them, and they didn't care. So you read a medieval Christian version of an old Greek or Roman story, and they will often have them going to the temple, and they'll call it the temple of, you know, Jove or whatever, because they know it's supposed to be there. They were worshiping Jove. But it will look and sound exactly like a church. I mean, it looks exactly like a cathedral. The services that they have look exactly like Christian services. You know, it's basically like Christianity barely dressed up to look like something else, because they're not making any attempt to actually integrate it or to actually represent Greco-Roman religion or anything else. And I think Tolkien would have been really uncomfortable writing something that kind of looked like that. Like, you know, I am theoretically writing about this different world, this different society in which, you know, Christ has not come. There is no actual Christianity here. But I'm going to make them have churches and do things which look exactly like Christian worship. That would have been a violation of his whole sub-creative principle.
Like the Knight's Tale.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I was thinking of.
The Knight's Tale, Chaucer's Knight's Tale, I think is actually an interesting example, because there you have something which is actually like pagan worship. The pagan rites, the Greco-Roman pagan rites in Chaucer's Knight's Tale are some of the least anachronistic religious rites in the Middle Ages. And it's remarkable when you compare, in Chaucer's other writing, I mean, you compare the temple scene in Chaucer's Troilus and Crusade with the sacrifice that Emily gives to Diana, and even the burial of our seat at the end of it is a very, I mean, the cremation of our seat was very close to a pagan ritual, and he even cites his source.
And then there's the speech.
The speech about it, yeah, which is really great. But anyway, Tolkien clearly didn't want to be doing even that kind of thing. He's not doing, I'm going to try to be true to these other worships of these other ancient peoples. I'm going to try to, like, have something which is almost Christian, but is dressed up in other clothing. He didn't do that. And so instead what he has is a world which is philosophically, metaphysically, very thoroughly Christian, but in which there's no worship, because they are all in this sort of pre-Christian state, culturally.
Is it possible that in terms of this, Tolkien's making a statement on the difference between knowing and faith? Like, believing and knowing? Because there are elves still alive who haven't been around since the formation of the world, but they've been to Valinor and back, and they've seen the Valar who have been around since the creation of everything, and have seen the One, Eru.
Yeah.
And
I mean, I think that that's possible. I mean, in part, if you think about what is the, and this, of course, gets into deep Christian theological waters pretty quickly. But that is, you think about what is the point of religious worship at all.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the points of Christian religious worship would not apply to elves, especially to elves living in Valinor. Now, again, to actually, like, define and make an exhaustive list of what is the point of Christian worship is, I think, beyond our purposes here. But clearly, some of them, anyway, would not be required of elves. They're in a completely different place. They're immortal. You know, their relationship with it, when they're living in Valinor, especially, it's that situation is so different from the situation of either human beings in a pre-Christian era or human beings in a post-Christian era, that it's actually a little bit, there's no real reason even to expect that they would have any practices that would look like what we would identify as religious practices.
And that's all we had time for on that day. There were still a few questions left over, which I brought to a second session recorded early this week, so that will be available soon. Also, remember that I will be having another Skype call-in session within 24 hours of the posting of this episode at 3 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Thursday, June 3rd, and the recording of the last Skype session should also be posted within the week. Thanks for listening, and Godspeed.